Patricia O'Connor is a former editor at the New York Times Book Review and the author of Origins of the Specious and Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. Now in its third edition, Woe is wildly successful and has made its author the last word in using words. But it wasn't always so.
When I went to work at the Times, of course, the first thing I did was read the Times-style book so I could do everything the company way. And under the entry for none, it said, construe as plural, unless there's a good reason not to. And I thought, this is very odd of the Times. This must just be one of those Times idiosyncrasies. And I thought this for many years until I wrote my first book, Woe Is I, which was a grammar book, and I researched none. And lo and behold, the Times is right. It really should be construed as plural unless there's a good reason not to, because the etymology, strictly speaking, it doesn't mean not one. It means not any. So it can be either singular or plural. Now, if you said not any of the chickens are hatched, of course, that's plural. If you said not any of the milk is spilled, that's singular. So none can be either singular or plural. If it applies to a plural, it's absolutely. Yeah.
But things change. Things change, and we don't notice they're changing. And I gather from a lot of the stories that you tell that they change round and round and round. The question of English versus American English, for instance. You make the case that American English probably sounds more like the English English of the time of division than what we call British English does.
It's true. The characteristics that we Americans chiefly associate with the educated British accent, all those characteristics came to the British after the Revolutionary War, roughly between 1790 and about 1820.
So things like dropping that, the R or
dropping
broadening the
R, or saying fa instead of far, or saying past instead of past, or pronouncing the H in the word herb, or dropping a syllable in a word like secretary and saying secretary or necessary or military. All of those characteristics developed after the Great Divide, which means that earlier in the 18th century, the Brits, in some respects, sounded the way Americans do today.
And so that Oxbridge accent, the one that we all associate with upper-class British citizens, is less,
a late development.
Less true. It's a late development.
Yes. In fact, people often ask me, when did Americans lose their British accents? It's a good question. The answer is that we never had them. There are other myths about American versus British English having to do with grammar, that the British are more grammatically correct. Not necessarily true. We've preserved elements of grammar that the British have dropped. We've kept the subjunctive mood, for example.
Give me an example.
Where we say, if I were king, or I suggested that he get a job, rather than the British would say, I suggest that he gets a job. So we've preserved more of the subjunctive mood. We've preserved both of the past participles of the verb to get. We say both got and gotten. They used to have both got and gotten, and they dropped gotten along the way. Now, a lot of Brits, for example, think that the word fall for the season of the year is an Americanism. Not so. At one time, both the British and the Americans used both words, fall and autumn. Now, Americans use both words, but the British use only autumn.
One of the other things I loved in this, and again surprised me so much, is discovering how many of the words that we accept as standards in our language were invented by people within our collective memory. How many words George Washington created, for instance?
Oh, yes. Washington, he created a lot of very surprising ones that you wouldn't have suspected. He created, let's see, what was it, non-discrimination? Yeah, the phrase non-discrimination. He invented indoors.
Indoors.
He invented off-duty. He invented paroled. And he invented, this kills me, he invented the word bakery.
George Washington invented the word bakery?
He invented the word bakery. He invented the term hatchet man. which I think is funny because he didn't mean it in the way we mean it today. He meant a pioneer, someone who goes and clears forests. And I think it's ironic that someone who was mythologically accused of whacking a cherry tree invented the word hatchet man.
Yes, I agree. Well, and his colleagues, the men of his time, other founding fathers of America, Jefferson, oh, yeah. Adams.
Jefferson even invented the word neologize, which is to create new words, because he was so fond of creating new words.
He loved it so much he created a word for it.
Yes, he introduced public relations. He introduced the verb belittle, which I think is a charming verb, actually. He introduced lengthily as an adverb, lengthily, electioneering, indecipherable, and he invented monotonously, and, oh, he invented the word pedicure.
You wonder what the reaction was the first time any of these words appeared in a sentence.
Yeah, I know. And when I say they invented them, what I'm saying is they were credited with having the first recorded use. Now, it may be that Jefferson heard this from someone else.
Oh, you know, that doesn't make nearly as good a story, though.
I know, it doesn't. But in the interest of full disclosure, I have to say that.
Well, it does suggest that fame has its perks, doesn't it?
Yes. Now, Lincoln came up with some interesting new words. He first used relocate and relocation, and he invented the expression point well taken.
Ah.
Now, it's been made so trite, but at the time, it must have been impressive.
At the time, it must have been a point well taken.
Yes.
What's the most fun for you in all of this? You said it's become such a part of your life now that you're not shocked by it anymore.
These days, I almost assume if I think I know something, it's probably a myth. There are so many myths out there, but sometimes I even perpetrate them myself. I do a regular monthly radio program on WNYC in New York, and when I was on the air with a caller, he said something about something was a rule of thumb, and I said, oh, it's too bad you have to use a phrase with such a bad history, because rule of thumb comes from an old English common law that said a husband is allowed to beat his wife with a stick, a rod or stick, no thicker than his thumb. And I thought that was true. I had read it a few times. Even in the New York Times, I had read it. Well, when I got home, I had an email from a better informed source who said, check it out. And so I did, and sure enough, it was a myth. The expression rule of thumb is very interesting. It was invented in the 1600s, and it comes from an old tradition of using the parts of the body as rough forms of measurement. For example, the thumb is about an inch wide. A man's foot is about a foot long, which is why that measurement is called a foot. A fathom. Well, fathom comes from an old English verb meaning to encircle with one's arms. And a fathom, the noun, was the length of a man's arms when stretched out to his sides from fingertip to fingertip. It was later standardized at 6 feet and used to measure things, including water depths. The fathom. And now we use it metaphorically, of course, to mean to be able to get your mind around something is to fathom it. But there are other ones. The hand, the width of the palm is about 4 inches. So a hand's width was about 4 inches. And we used to measure things in hands. We still do horses that way. You say a horse is 15 hands high, that means 60 inches at the withers. So there were all these body parts that we used as rough forms of measurement, and that's how rule of thumb came along. A rule of thumb meant a rule that's an approximation, a guess, an estimate. That's a rule of thumb, and it's been around the 1600s. And the truth is, there never was any British law or American law that said a man has a right to beat his wife with a rod or stick no thicker than his thumb. That's a myth.
Patricia O'Connor's books are called Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English, and the new one, Origins of the Specious, Myths and Misconceptions of the English Language,